Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Writer Network. My guest today is Diana Johnstone, PhD. She's a native of Minnesota, raised in New Deal, Washington. Diana Johnstone has spent more than half her life in Europe as a political observer and journalist, working for Agency France Press, France's European correspondent, and as press officer for the Green Group in the European Parliament. She holds a BA in Russian Area Studies and a PhD in French Literature. She's author of three books, including Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions, and co-author with her father, Paul H. Johnstone, of From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon Nuclear War Planning. And her most recent book, which is excellent, is Circle in the Darkness, Memoir of a World Watcher. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So at the very beginning, in fact, I think on the first page of your book, you bring up the notion of a moral environment. Can you start by talking a little bit about that?
Well, that was based on my recollections of my childhood. And I was speaking about the fact that when you have a long life, as I do, you can feel the moral environment change, as I have. And you see, in my childhood, I was a child in the Depression, and there was a kinder atmosphere than there is today. And there was more of a sense of concern for others and modesty. And today I feel that we are living in a really horrible moral environment. I mean, you see, then there were a lot of people who were poor and out of work and so on, but somehow there was more humanity. There was more concern. Today's atmosphere is one of extraordinary selfishness, arrogance, hostility. Of course, this is our dear leaders are setting this atmosphere, but it seems to be more and more pervasive. The hostility between people and there's a great shift, which I feel.
And, you know, kind of like the cliche about, you know, fish not necessarily knowing about water and us not necessarily knowing about air. You know, we are raised in the conditions that we are raised in which we're raised. And, you know, you have, like my mother did, my mother died 2 years ago, and she was born in the 30s. And she also had experience of different times. And I grew up in the age before computers, the last generation really before computers. And I'm just commenting on how we seem to, this is what age is supposed to do, I think, is give us perspective on similarities and changes that one can't have if one's only lived in one's own moral environment.
I think that's true. And you see, it's rather appalling that one of the aspects of today's moral environment is complete contempt for the wisdom of age. I mean, you know, the thing now is to shove people into some place where with other old people where they can die, and there's no idea now. The idea is that the younger you are, the more you know what it's all about, and that goes against traditional wisdom of the ages. It's a very new thing. But it goes along with the market economy. What is new is best, and so on. It's part of the superficiality of our times.
So can we move to your book follows chronologically, and can we move up to where you were a journalist? And there was a line that you said early on. I just want to introduce this concept to use it later. That as you were working as a journalist, stories had to be framed in certain ways. So can you introduce the notion of the press not simply, or anyone, not simply stating facts, but framing stories that fit a larger narrative? And we're gonna move later into into what happens when journalists or anyone tries to frame it according to a different narrative than the common one.
Well, yes. At first, I was in the journalistic milieu because I was married to American journalist working for the Associated Press in Germany, and at that time, what was demanded by editors in New York were stories that were in the framework of the Cold War, of the great rivalry between the Soviet Union as the bad place of communism and the good place was the West and the United States and freedom and all that. And what the editors wanted were stories that would fit into that framework of that great competition. Who's winning? Well, of course, we had to be winning all the time. That's part of the frame. And this just incited journalists to fit the stories to the framework that has been more or less established by editors. And I mean, a huge example of that. Now, that was the Cold War when I say back in those days. But then the most shocking example that I saw, well, two shocking, several, but that I witnessed was the war in Yugoslavia, the so-called Kosovo War, because that was a situation which, for various reasons, I happened to have familiarity with, having lived there as a student. And journalists were really sent out there to fit their stories into the framework that there's this bad Serbs with this bad leader who was called a dictator, although he was totally democratically elected. I'm talking about Milosevic. He was perfectly democratically elected. Besides that, he was head of a coalition government. He wasn't a tyrant. He didn't control the press, which was mostly against him. But since we didn't like him, he was presented as a dictator and a thug. And journalists would just automatically write that without paying any attention to the facts. Just, there was a framework. There was a bad guy who you could compare to Hitler because that's the way you compare people we don't like, leaders we don't like, who was to blame for this tragic breakup of a multicultural nation. And really, journalists came out there who knew nothing about the situation and the history, and they would write the stories practically before getting there to fit this pattern. And so then it's so much repeated that it comes as if it's the obvious truth about the matter because people have just heard this framework over and over again. And that was a very horrible example to me because it was just about impossible to get any truth through to the public because editors, including left-wing publications, demanded that frame. They didn't want to hear anything else. They decided that this was, you know, who's the bad guy and who are the good guys, and you just keep writing this fairy tale. And that was really a stunning case to me of the impossibility of getting into the media with the truth about a situation. And of course, it leads to tragedy.
So unless I missed it, I believe you said that you were going to use two examples, and that was one example. Did you have another one?
Well, another one was the destruction of Libya, which went much faster. But that, again, you had a bad guy, Gaddafi, who's obviously a bad guy. Who knows anything about him? I mean, you know, he's a Berber, you know, he's a North African. What's that? And he was the bad guy, and there were total lies told about it, and the whole media and the Western governments went with that and destroyed the country.
So before we move on, how are these, and maybe this is beyond the scope of the interview, but how are these frames how do we collectively, or how do, you said editors determine frames, but it's not editors running all of society. How do these frames get, I'm sure chosen might not be the right word, but how do these frames gain hegemony?
Yeah, well, actually, editors do decide, but of course, editors are working for people. Editors are, it's institutional. It's institutional, and if I want to go back to the cause of this, if I try to find a major cause, I have to go back to the military-industrial complex, which has ended up fashioning American society to a tremendous degree, because it's become a key element in the economy. Every congressman gets some money from the military-industrial complex for his circumscription. You see, the war machine, of course, it's making weapons everywhere, but it's also buying uniforms. It's also funding universities. The money of the military-industrial complex is just all over society. Now, it doesn't dominate everything, but it's there, and it's in order to justify all this use of our wealth, of the country's riches, into preparing for war, there has to be an ideology to justify that. And so this ideology is created jointly by think tanks, the entertainment industry, and the press is a bit a part of the entertainment industry. So finding the foreign villain that we must correct in some way, it fits right into this mega narrative, which is in the movies all the time. I mean, you know, our entertainment is geared to preparing for war. Everything is presented in this pattern of some bad guy is going to do something terrible, but then there are victims, and then the good guy has to save the victims. And you have this over and over and over, and the pattern is such that people almost automatically look for every event to be shaped like that. And the fact is that comes down to serving particular interests that dominate American society. And this has become worse and worse over the decades.
Thank you so much for that. And there's two directions I'm thinking right now. One of them is one of the lines that I love from your book is that you talked about how fascism requires a charismatic dictator. And you said today's charismatic dictator is the information and entertainment industry. But the other direction, I want to come back to that a little bit later. The other direction is, can you put during your lifetime, the left has transformed. And this is one of the things I really wanted to interview you about, because you are one of the most eloquent people, I think, in the world on this. There are so many people, so many old school lefties I know who say, I feel politically homeless. And, oh, there's someone else. I'm sorry. There's another place I want to go first, which is you also wrote that you think it's really important to – it's more important to criticize your own side than the other side. And I've taken a lot of flack because I criticize the left a lot, and I have not spent as much time, for example, criticizing Trump. And from my perspective, like, the problems with Trump are self-evident. I'm going to see if I can really quickly find the exact quote you did. If I can't, we can just – if you could talk about it, that'd be great.
I can talk about that because I think it starts – I think the starting point of that observation is a conscience, is having a conscience individually. I mean, having a conscience means starting with self-criticism before you criticize others. I think it's a basic basis of morality is to be self-critical. And this is also true if you're in a society. You have a responsibility for your own society. This is in, I think I mentioned it in terms of international relations. I'm not there to tell the Russians what they should be doing because I can't do anything. If I criticize them or if we criticize them, it's not going to make them better. It's going to make them feel that we're hostile to them, which is the case. In fact, if we weren't hostile to them, maybe we could criticize in a more kindly way. But when you have decided that somebody is an enemy, criticizing that person or entity is simply going to be seen as an aspect of your hostility. Whereas what citizenship or conscience or anything should be is the criticism should start at home and see what we are doing wrong, what I am doing wrong, and trying to correct that. And then if you're going to give moral lessons, you should start by example. If I can just say that right now the United States is preaching democracy to the world, but it's not giving a wonderful example.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. That's, and that's one of the things that I find really distressing, and we can sort of start sidling into the left now. One of the things I find really distressing is an all too common tendency to have the cliche of rules for thee but not me, such that one does not we'll eventually get to Antifa probably, but the Antifa notion that what they're doing is punching fascists, and then fascists, who's a fascist? Well, anybody we disagree with. Well, that means that basically what they're saying is they get to punch anybody they disagree with. And there's absolutely no self-critique in that. There's no self-awareness of the fairly obvious thing that if you disagree with Antifa, you're a fascist, and then it's okay for them to assault fascists, which means that they basically, not basically, but they propagate their ideology through violence and not through disagreement. And it's the same. I'm not simply blaming Antifa. We see the same behavior in lots of places where, you know, the other side does something and that's outrageous, and we do the same thing and we've got it fully excused. You know, Robert J. Lifton talked about the importance of claims to virtue before you can commit any atrocity. You have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is in fact good and not harmful.
Well, yes. And you know, all of the, you said they spread their ideology that way. I don't think they do. I'm not sure what their ideology is, for one thing. In fact, shutting people up who disagree with you, that ideology, if you want, and it's not exactly a progressive one.
Well, that's a good, I'm sorry, did you have more?
No, well, I might, but good.
Well, we'll come back to it. So I wanted to go to the question of what has happened to the left. And I started to say this earlier, that so many people, old school lefties, say, I feel politically homeless. I didn't leave the left left me. I don't even recognize the left. Can you talk about the transformation of the left from, at one point, at least, and this is when I was too young, so, you know this, but I can only read about it, where at one point the left at least pretended to care about working class people, or maybe it really did. I don't know. It's before my time. As opposed to now, working class people can be called the deplorables. How did it get moved from a class-based analysis to an identity-based analysis and to the general sort of madness that it's at right now?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to say about this. Of course, it's quite complicated. And I think, let's start with the idea of class. I think part of the decline of the left starts with the the victory of Marxism, the Marxist philosophy, was because not so much Marx. Marx was analyzing capital, and it's a very complicated thing. It shouldn't be simplified. But the Marxist movement sort of won because it had a triumphalist ideology that the class struggle, that the working class was going to make the revolution the way the bourgeoisie had made the bourgeois revolution. The idea that there's an upcoming class that will transform society. And Marx spoke of, the Marxists spoke of the working class as if it were parallel to the bourgeoisie, which had overthrown aristocracy and monarchy. And that this working class was historically destined to transform society. Now, I think there are things basically wrong with that, because the bourgeoisie throughout history has always been a sort of co-dominant class. That's a very complicated thing, but the bourgeoisie was not oppressed. It was up there. But the working class did not make the revolution. The revolutions that were made, Marxist revolutions, were made largely undeveloped societies, where in fact the peasantry was very strong, and the revolutions were largely a matter of modernization rather than of making socialism as it had been demanded. And in the West, a lot of the most extreme leftist leaders were very disappointed because our working class did not make the revolution as it was supposed to. And the intellectuals started looking out for somebody else to make their revolution instead of the working class. And they started looking for, well, it'll be women that will make or it'll be blacks, or it'll be gays or something, which frankly to my mind doesn't make any sense, because the point that the working class could have made the revolution was because of its strategic position in manufacturing, because it could stop manufacturing, which would stop profits, which would stop capitalism. It was the strategic position of the working class that made it be the candidate for the revolution. All these other groups, and certainly transsexuals, et cetera, are in no position to stop society and make a revolution. So all these dreams about another agent, which was very popular in the later 20th century, were just confusion, just caused immense confusion among intellectuals who, for one reason or other, sort of lost their interest in the working class and started sponsoring various minorities, first of all, as possible agents of revolution. And there were other ideas of the left that got totally turned around. The working class was dropped in favor of minorities. Internationalism, which had been between working class of different countries, was replaced by globalization and idealization of immigration, which is not the same thing at all. Anti-war was replaced by belief in humanitarian war for human rights. Political parties, when you had like the Communist Party of France, they were the workers. The workers were in that party. They funded the party. Even officials of the party would give part of their income back to the party. Those were working class parties. They have disappeared, and the good causes instead are forwarded not by parties but by NGOs, who tend to be dependent on donors, and the donors tend to be rich people. And so there's just the working class has just lost any clout there. And then meanwhile, in academia, in the universities, public education was I always thought, you see, that the duty of intellectuals who had the privilege of learning things is to share this knowledge and educate the public. But instead of that, after the Vietnam War, the intellectuals in the university tended to go into theorizing revolutions. And that led finally to all sorts of abstruse studies, and now impose correct views on the university, rather than educating the people on all the things that the people should know about. And so you have really, in the United States, if I may make the comment, a very ignorant population about the world. You see that when in this campaign, where people throw around the word socialism with absolutely no resemblance to what socialism means anywhere. There's just total confusion. And then add to that, the complexity of the contemporary world makes things very hard for everybody to understand. And it's just easier to come up with simple, very simple dichotomies, of good and bad and things you should say and shouldn't say, without any understanding of what real dangers there are. And of course, then leading into identity politics, which is a very funny thing is that some of the opponents of identity politics call it neo-Marxism, and it's absolutely the opposite of Marxism, or of socialism or any progressive movement. It's the dead opposite.
So before we move on more with that, which then again, thank you. I just have to say that throughout this whole interview, I'm marveling at the things you say. This is so great. As long as you're talking about academics and also moving away from social, well, I'll just read it. You have this wonderful quote about Foucault, and if you could talk about the harm that Foucault has done, because he's sort of a god. It strikes me as just so weird that he's considered a god among some of the left. Because anyway, Foucault was preaching a very different message. Well, in the USSR, power meant the gulag. Here at home, it was everywhere. The ubiquitous nature of power, this is you writing, virtually eliminated the focus on hierarchies of power, on the possibility of consciously organizing individuals to work together against the major political power centers. If power is everywhere, power is nowhere in particular. Resisting power can mean resisting your teacher, your parents, the law, even the doctor. Foucault's immense influence on American academia can be seen in today's resistance to every possible micropower, taking the form of witch hunts against alleged instances of discrimination, racism, exclusion, professors, speakers, or texts which use words which might hurt somebody's feelings. Meanwhile, opposition to the macro powers of finance capital, the military-industrial examples, NATO, and the pro-war leaders in the West is weak, marginalized, and ineffective. That's one of the best descriptions I've ever seen of the problem of the collapse of the left. Can you go on about that a little bit more?
Well, yeah, you see, I can get back to what my idea. When I talk about Foucault, I mention an interview, a rather famous interview, which you can see on the internet with Chomsky, where it came to the question of fairness. And the final issue was that according to Foucault, there isn't any fair. He had decided that week anyway to be on the side of the working class, because he was also ended up being much of a neoliberal in many ways. But because it was negative to change power, and he was saying that he had that there could be, and finally there could be no, there, he didn't think believe in fairness basically, and I come to that. I mean, let me just say I have a sort of basic notion of the basis of human morality, which I think is in human nature, does values are truth and fairness, because I think fairness is something that depends on truth and reason. And this triad of truth, fairness, reason is what can bring people together so that they can talk things over and to make decisions and live together. And when you don't care about truth or fairness or reason, you're going to have absolute chaos. And Foucault really didn't care about any of those things. And you see the constant demand for everyone for power, empowerment of everybody. When you empower one person or group, it can be at the expense of others. So really it raises the question of fairness, and just demanding more power is leading toward the war of all against all. And you see, the identity politics tells people, you know, to identify with this particular group. And usually this identification tends to be justified on the grounds that this group that I say I belong to has been a victim of somebody or some other. And of course, there are several things wrong with that. It's directed toward the past. It's focusing on the past, and with an underlying sense of vengeance. But worst of all, it philosophically, it goes against both individuality and universality. I mean, this focus on I'm this or I'm that, I'm a black or I'm a woman or I'm whatever I am. And this has some essential factor that puts me apart from others. First of all, it's denying individuality, which goes way beyond whatever this group identity is. People are a lot of things. Anybody is a lot of things. And you should be able to identify with people who are completely different from yourself. And also it says nothing about the qualities you have or don't have. And so it also goes against universality, because it goes against the sense of what we all share. And so it's very inhuman. It's very anti-human. And I'll tell you, I think it's heading very nicely toward the robot society that is being planned in certain places.
I'm thinking of something else that you wrote that is, can we hit just a little bit more you've talked about internationalism and nationalism and globalization. And another question I really wanted to ask you, and you've talked about this a little bit, can you even as recently as the late 90s, the left was opposed to globalization, like the WTO riots. And you know, we can critique various things that happened there, but the point is that at one point the left was solidly against globalization and opposed NAFTA, GATT, etc. And that has been transformed somehow into the world, and as you pointed out in your book, the old class-based left was not necessarily in favor of absolutely open borders, because they that could easily harm working class people. And before we go any further, I think you and I would probably agree that much immigration comes because, or especially refugees come because of the depredations of capitalism in the third world country. It's not like they go to the San Joaquin Valley for an eco tour of the strawberry fields. They're coming up because their own community has been hammered by transnational corporations. So how did that transformation take place and one more thing, you also mentioned, and I'm a student of history and I didn't know this, so I thought this was great, that nation states in some ways arose in response to religious wars, or did I misread? Anyway, so can you just talk about the left's changing position and how the left has become sort of foot soldiers for globalization?
Yeah.
It's very confusing to me.
The thing is, of course, I'm living in Europe, and to be precise, in France. What's funny is that this has happened all over, but in slightly different ways in different countries. I mean, the ideological basis of this can be different in different places. I mean, back when there was a French Communist Party that amounted to something, George Marchais was very clear about the fact, which is, I think, pretty well established, that the property class wants immigration because it brings down the cost of labor. It not only brings down the cost of labor, it also let's face it, it can make it harder for the working class to organize in self-defense against management. In fact, this is so true that American industry traditionally brought in immigrants of different ethnic groups and kept them separate or apart. I think I was amazed, like when I visited Detroit, to see that there's this Polish city right in the middle of Detroit. And the ethnic mix is very favorable to management, as a divide and rule strategy. But there's something else that's recent about it, and that's the globalization. There is no question that the global elite has for the last decades very clearly been out to undermine the nation state, except for its police activities. And the nation state has been, especially in Europe, using the history of the 20th century to condemn nationalism. The nation state has been totally identified simply with the negative aspects of the nation state, namely making war, overlooking the fact that the nation state is the one place where people have been able to organize for social welfare. And the movement of great capital and finance capital to break down the nation state goes hand in hand with breaking down the social welfare state. Now, open borders really is getting rid of the nation state and having one big conglomerate of ethnic mix everywhere. I don't think that's going to happen, but that is sort of the direction that has been, things have been going to, I think it's coming to an end, by the way, for various reasons. But the left bought into that. There was a huge propaganda, and the left bought into that as thinking that internationalism meant open borders. That is not the case at all. And as a fact, more astute leftists such as Sarah Wagenknecht in Germany, for instance, point out that open borders, and I'm talking now from the European standpoint, means encouraging the most active use of people in the third world to come to Europe and leave their own country behind instead of building their own country. So that it is negative. Now, of course, if you look at places in Latin America, I mean, you can look at Honduras and think people come to from Honduras because the United States has made it into a hellhole by overthrowing any decent leader it might have and so on. But that's not the case everywhere. And the encouragement of immigration breaks up the societies on both ends and is not good for people getting together to improve their conditions either at one end or the other.
So you have a great line here on page 416, which is a left fixated on 1933 to 1945 as universal paradigm identifies nationalism with Adolf Hitler instead of Ho Chi Minh, Amilcar Cabral, Mahatma Gandhi, Simon Bolivar, Patrick Henry, and a whole array of historic liberators. I just find that really interesting because I've fallen into that trap too, that when somebody says nationalist at this point, it's you know, them's fighting words. That's an insult. But, you know, Mahatma Gandhi or Simon Bolivar were heroes. I just find that so thank you for that observation.
You're welcome. And I think it's important because, I mention that because there is this terrible fixation on that period as if the paradigm for all of history was a small, very small period of years. And part of it is, I think, because part of it is because for various reasons, the Holocaust has become sort of the official religion of the West. Certainly in France, this is quite striking. The difficulty with that is that it's a very a negative model of history to have the event in history that you think about the most being the Holocaust is pretty depressing. And it does suggest the hopelessness of anything. And it has ended up, I mean, the Holocaust took place during World War II. It was part of World War II. It was the elimination of the internal enemy, which for Hitler was the Jews. But it should be a lesson in the horrible things that happen in war. And instead of that, it has become used, especially by the United States, but the Europeans do the same thing. But especially the United States has used that as an excuse to make war because there might be another Holocaust. And they use that danger of a Holocaust in the Kosovo War when there was no such danger whatsoever, none, again in Libya. So the Holocaust, this focus on this one horrible event, has become used by the West as a propaganda weapon to make war. This is extremely ironic and horrible, actually.
You know, on page 421, you say, much of the far left sees its villains in purely moral rather than political economic terms. People on the right are simply bad people with bad attitudes. And also, to bring World War II into this, they're obviously fascists, Nazis, etc. Anyway, for the Antifa in particular, people on the extreme right, for them a broad category, must be opposed by censorship or violence, not by rational argument. And that brings up two more things I want. We're really coming to a close here, but there's a couple more quotes I want to do and see if you can bring them all together. One is the thing I mentioned earlier, today's charismatic dictator is the information entertainment industry. And the final one is censorship. Oh, this great line. Well, here's another great line. There's so many. First off, there's this. The government rarely censors. Censorship is privatized. And two more things, and then I just want you to sum everything up. The fight for truth is the most critical battle in our emerging civil wars. So long as people fail to distinguish between manipulation and honesty, between truth and falsehood, they can neither define correctly what is wrong nor find solutions. Absolutely brilliant. And then finally, there's the question. You know, many of the things that you've been talking about today and many things you've talked about in your career have gone against the common framing. And what happens to people who go against the common framing? So if you could answer those and then sort of try to sum up what you want listeners to take away from this interview, that would be great.
Well, yes. You know, the fact is that I've been I don't know what to say because I've been pretty much marginalized all the time. I have just seen that when you go up against the what is considered the story, the way it's supposed to be told, it's very hard to. I don't know. I just don't know what to say except to plug ahead because I don't. Again, I think if you rather be satisfied with it, if you care about truth and care about and have a conscience and are concerned about what you are doing rather than how you appear, you can keep looking for the truth. The big difficulty, again, to get back to the moral environment today, is that we're in a very superficial mode where everything is supposed to be external values. People are selling themselves and are really ready to do anything to sell themselves. And that means that not caring so much about what they are on the inside, but how they are valued on the outside. And I'm afraid that you see a lot of people who have gone into the communications business are wanting to be approved by their people who will hire them or give them a career or something and don't really care that much about the importance of telling the truth. And that unconcern for truth is really is very spectacular in this society of spectacle, a society of appearances, a society of being popular, of selling yourself and so on. But I don't think there's much personal satisfaction in getting ahead because you're willing to lie.
Well, that would be a wonderful place to end, but I have one more question, which is, given the moral environment in which we live, given everything you've said, how, in addition to telling the truth, how can we change the moral environment? And also, how can we either retake the left from those who have destroyed it or make a new left that is not as completely insane?
Well, I would want to base it on what I said, not finding a group, whether it's the working class or anybody else, to be an agent of the revolution. I mean, people should be concerned about the welfare of the working class simply because you should be concerned about the welfare of the working class, not because they can make a revolution. I think there has to be a broadening. I think there has to be absolutely a broadening, not concerned about identities of who you are or what category you fit into. There has to be uniting around having a fair, decent society, and that with the idea that anybody should be able to be part of that. And if somebody is taken to be a fascist, well, that's a human being. Then maybe you talk to that person and you find out that that person has some decency that you can appeal to. And I think there has to be I don't see anything except to try to find some human qualities in human beings before we're all replaced by artificial intelligence, which I think is the danger. If people don't, assert their humanity is going to be taken away from them entirely.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for everything you've said. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Diana Johnstone. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.